Welcome to the Lean Blog Podcast. Visit our website at www.leanblog.org. Now, here's your host, Mark Graben.
Hi, this is Mark Graben. Welcome to episode 127 for August 17th, 2011. Today's episode is a very special conversation with a world leader and a hero of mine in the realm of patient safety improvement. He is Dr. Richard P. Shannon. He's a cardiologist and is chair of the Department of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, as well as the senior vice chair for clinical affairs in the Department of Medicine. Now, Dr. Shannon was an early pioneer in the use of Lean and Toyota methods to improve outcomes and patient safety, namely the reduction of hospital-acquired central line bloodstream infections and ventilator-associated pneumonia when he was at Allegheny General Hospital near Pittsburgh, as was documented in Neda Grunden's outstanding book called The Pittsburgh Way to Efficient Healthcare, Improving Patient Care Using Toyota-Based Methods. Now, with the Pittsburgh connections, Dr. Shannon originally learned about Lean and Toyota methods from PRHI, the Pittsburgh Regional Health Initiative, and from Paul O'Neill, who was my guest back in episode 124. So if you want to find that episode, you can go to leanblog.org/124. The blog post and page for this episode is leanblog.org/127. And if you want to make sure you catch every episode, you can subscribe real easily in the Apple iTunes store, or for more options, go to www.leanpodcast.org. I'm also happy to say that this podcast episode is produced in conjunction with the Healthcare Value Network. To learn more, you can go to www.healthcarevalueleaders.org, or you can visit the website of the Theta Care Center for Healthcare Value at www.createhealthcarevalue.com. Well, Dr. Shannon, thanks for taking time to talk on the podcast today.
It's great to be with you, Mark.
If you can start, maybe just introduce yourself and your role and your background for the listeners, please.
Sure. I'm the chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania here in Philadelphia. And I, for about the last decade, have been engaged in a redefinition of my career, one where I've taken a much more compelling interest in process improvement, particularly toward the elimination of harm to patients in our hospitals. And so I think our acquaintance is occasioned by the idea of using tools such as lean methodologies in hospitals, subject about which you've written and about which I've read from you, as a way to get better and better at everything we do in the delivery of care to patients.
Yeah, and a lot of that, or the initial redefinition, if you will, started back in Pittsburgh. And I was wondering if you could talk about some of the origins of how you first got exposed to some of these ideas. Listeners may have heard I did an interview with Paul O'Neill a couple of weeks back. I wonder if you can share some of your history in that regard.
Sure. Well, in fact, my kind of redefining my career occurred as a result of a chance meeting with Paul O'Neill at a time when he was still the CEO at Alcoa. And at that particular time, the chairman of the Allegheny Conference, which was a group of the large businesses in Pittsburgh. And in his role as the chair, he called together all of the hospital leadership from across the southwestern Pennsylvania area to ask them to be held accountable for cardiovascular outcomes in the area of cardiac surgeries. At that time, Pennsylvania was, with New York, among the earliest to publicly report outcomes in cardiac surgeries, and Mr. O'Neill noticed wide variations in outcomes and wide variations in payments attributable to that, and basically challenged leaders to say that businesses were struggling under the weight of double-digit increases in healthcare costs and yet weren't seeing value attributable to it. And as responsible people within the Pittsburgh community, we had to come together to figure that out. So it was indeed a chance occurrence. At that meeting, I was actually asked to defend the honor of my institution at that time because our results weren't that good. And as I began to give the traditional litany of excuses why we didn't quite hit the mark. You know, Paul said that was all very nice, but the job of leaders is to take away excuses by redefining the way in which work was done toward the elimination of waste and harm. And the day later, Paul O'Neill and I had lunch, and it's created a decade-long friendship and a great decade-long mentorship of, I think, someone who in industry really applied the ideas of Lean to the extraordinary improvement of Alcoa.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you share a little bit of some of the method and approach of looking at reducing hospital-acquired infections, the use of methods or ideas inspired by Toyota, standardized work, looking at different quality methods? Can you talk through some of that process and share some of the results that you had, at least initially there in Pittsburgh?
Sure. I think that the concept was to first be transparent about the problem and to decode the existing data from what was shrouded in complex epidemiologic metrics such as infections per 1,000 Lyme days, and rather tell the individual stories of patients and their unfortunate outcomes that were occasioned by getting these infections. So decoding the data in order to make it meaningful to people that did the work. So on the one hand, you know, 7.6 infections per 1,000 Lyme days may mean something to an epidemiologist, but it means nothing to a nurse or a physician or a nurse's assistant who is working at the point of care with patients that have these things. Yet if you say there are 56 people that had 62 infections, 20% of which died, that creates a very different definition of the problem. So the first step that I learned from industry, and one of the hardest steps still, is the strict definition of the problem based upon intense observations of the current condition. The next thing we did was we decided to break down the process of a central line into placing, maintaining, and manipulating the catheter. And then the idea was to have people that did the work define the standard processes around those things, test them, create countermeasures based upon the testing and the outcomes, and come to a conclusion about what the best way we knew we could come up with for placing, maintaining, and manipulating the catheter. So on the one hand, we had the advantage of some of the work that Peter Pronovost had done with checklists, all of which pertained to placing the catheter. But we discovered that the majority of central line infections actually occurred long after the catheter was placed, and so one not only needed standard work around placing catheters, but around maintaining catheters and how also those catheters could be manipulated. So workers made observations of how catheters were maintained and manipulated and defined standard work as to how to eliminate the variation. And the consequence was new practices and new procedures that dramatically reduced the central line infection rates among our patients. And in Pittsburgh, that occurred over a three-year period where, you know, we went from 49 infections down to 4 in those early days. And then doing similar work here at the University of Pennsylvania over a similar sort of 1,000-day journey, roughly 3 years, we've gone from 361 infections down to 11. So in the last fiscal year, 3 years after we've begun this standardized approach to placing, maintaining, and manipulating catheters, we've reduced the number of central line infections by close to 97%.
That's great, and to see that it's repeatable across other organizations is great to see. One before we move forward on that, I just want to go back maybe one thing you said and emphasize, you know, the idea of the people who did the work doing the observation and the creating of the standardized work, which is what, you know, going back even to Taiichi Ono and Toyota, what was taught. But there's a misperception, it seems, sometimes about standardized work or checklists that, you know, that this is something just being dictated to people. I was wondering if you could kind of comment on that, or, you know, the misperceptions or discussions that you've had with others in the industry about these ideas.
I think the key to the application of the principles of Toyota to healthcare is first the idea of bringing discipline and structure to problem solving. Using the four whys, using techniques such as 5S, and those are disciplined ways to think about problems. The second challenge is to take those tools and put them in the hands of people that actually do the work. And I think importantly, and one of the real aha moments we've had, is that really requires pulling people off the line and training them in these ideas, and then mentored Kaizen-like events around rapid cycle improvement as they redefine the work. So you need both skilled mentorship along the line, but you also need to train people in observations, in the creation of countermeasures, in deep, disciplined problem solving around Kaizen events in order to really engage the workforce. And I think some of the mistakes that are often made is that, you know, you could have a one-day seminar on lean thinking and people sit in a room and somehow, you know, as if manna from heaven receive this this inspiration. I think you really need to do this training on the line, at the point of care, in a very structured way so that workers can see the power of these tools. And I think that's perhaps the biggest innovation that we've been able to achieve here at Penn, is that we do a lot of structured, disciplined problem-solving exercises or Kaizens on the units at the point of care around problems identified by workers, and then mentor workers in solving those problems using the tools that Lean provides.
And because, you know, like you said, this isn't a quick fix, it seems it creates a challenge of where is the time? Everyone says, well, we don't, that sounds great, but we don't have time. Or are there some things that you've done? Is it just a leadership commitment to say we need to make the time available?
Well, I think you do need that leadership commitment. And let me say the way we've done this. So as we embarked on our effort here at Penn, we trained 220 nurses on our oncology units in the skills of observation, problem identification, by that I mean background, current condition, target condition, countermeasures, you know, anticipated outcomes, and then measured outcomes, and then a gap analysis around those things. Really structured problem-solving approaches. 220 nurses, and to do that, we actually had to take them away from their daily patient care routine to work with a mentor to develop these skills. Now, to accomplish that, we actually brought in one extra nurse each day shift and each night shift for a period of about 6 weeks in order that we could pull people off the line and engage them in this problem-solving capability. Once you teach people the power of these things and allow them the freedom to identify and solve problems in a structured way, you never go back. You never, ever lose that capability. So the initial upfront investment is really modest compared to the long-standing and sustainable power of developing those disciplined problem-solving capabilities. Now, Mark, if I may, by analogy, the analogy that we built to support this is nurses and doctors and social workers and case managers spend their day rounding on sick patients. And rounding on sick patients involves collecting history, doing a physical examination, creating therapeutic interventions. Each of those clinical tools has a systems counterpart. What's the background to the problem? What's the current condition based upon observations of the problem? So just as doctors, nurses, house staff, and others round on sick patients, we as leaders have to round on sick systems within our hospitals and apply the same kind of clinical reasoning. It's remarkable to me, the analogy, clinical reasoning that we do to sick patients to our sick systems. And we've used that analogy to take nurse managers and our unit-based clinical leadership teams, which are the structure we use here at Penn to apply these ideas, to have them focus on systems illnesses using lean kinds of methodology. And the final point about that is actually beginning next week, we're taking 12 of our medical residents through a three-day intensive deep dive into lean methodologies. And then for 32 weeks, are going to use these residents engaged on our medical units to create what we're calling the perfect patient discharge. That is to say, using lean tools, what does the patient want and need to make a successful transition from the hospital back to a level of health that is greater than that which they came in?
And that sounds reminiscent of some of the work from PRHI and the goal of perfect patient care.
Exactly. So I'd like to avoid what I consider to be the rhetoric or pejorative around readmissions, right, which is the sort of bellwether cause these days, and say that for any given patient, the goal is to get what they want and need to transition back to health at the time of discharge, and that if we do that, the consequence will be no one needs to be readmitted. But rather than focus on readmissions, which many organizations are doing, perfecting the process of transition of patients out of the hospital using lean tools is really the work that we're going to have these residents and our unit-based clinical leadership teams engaged in, all speaking the common language of lean methodologies.
Okay, and Dr. Shannon, maybe one last question here. You talk about six systems. I mean, we have them everywhere, whether it's Pittsburgh or Dallas or Boston or England. Can you share some thoughts on the spread and diffusion of the ideas that you've been sharing, things that Dr. Pranavost and Dr. Gawande have been sharing? What are your thoughts on the acceptance and adoption by leaders in other organizations?
So I would say that these ideas continue to gain momentum. So there has clearly been progress, greater acceptance of the idea of dealing with our sick delivery system and to perhaps use tools borrowed from high-performing industries to address those illnesses. But I think, Mark, it continues to be too slow. And where I think you see really great progress is in organizations such as Virginia Mason, where the CEO, Gary Kaplan, believes deeply in these ideas, or the ThetaCare system, where a CEO physician such as John Toussaint takes these ideas throughout an organization. I think folks like Peter Pranavost, Atul Gawande, and myself are kind of in the field working within those organizations and trying to demonstrate to other elements of our organization the powers of these ideas. But until the leaders of healthcare organizations themselves adapt these strategies, I think we won't get the kind of transformational change that the system needs. Now, I'm encouraged by some of the efforts emanating from CMS. I think Don Berwick is beginning to really articulate the idea of the elimination of waste through process redesign as the way to solve the CMS dilemma, as opposed to just across-the-board cuts. Whether in the timing, given the crisis in debt restructuring in the nation, he'll have time to do that, I don't know. But I think we're beginning to see these ideas permeate into healthcare in a deeper way, but it's not fast enough. The system really needs to begin to be transformed very quickly, and until leaders of healthcare organizations, academic medical centers adopt these strategies and implement them throughout their organizations, we'll have great islands of excellence, but we won't have cured the system.
Well, Dr. Shannon, I want to really thank you for taking time to continue sharing your story and hoping to inspire, helping to inspire others to continue improving their own systems and improving patient care in their own organization. So I want to wish you continued best wishes for your work there at University of Pennsylvania, and hopefully we can talk again soon.
Great. Thanks, Mark. Always nice to be with you.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Lean Blog Podcast. For lean news and commentary updated daily, visit www.leanblog.org. If you have any questions or comments about this podcast, email Mark at leanpodcast@gmail.com.